todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. My guest today is Chris Odell, the author of an incredible memoir called Miss Odell. Chris worked for Apple in the 60s, and she was in the studio when the Beatles recorded the White Album, Abbey Road and Let It Be, and she sang in the Hey Jude chorus. She lived with George Harrison and Patty Boyd and even got reluctantly involved in Patty's famous love story with Eric Clapton. She's also the subject of Leon Russell's song, Pisces Apple Lady. She's the woman down the hall in Joni Mitchell's song, Coyote, and the mystery woman pictured on the Stones album, Exile on Main Street, and the Miss Odell of George Harrison's song. She's even in my latest book, Rock and Roll Nightmares Phantom Chords, which has a chapter on the haunted goings-on at Friar Park, where she lived when she was working for George Harrison. I absolutely devoured her memoir, and I can't wait to find out more, so let's get her on the line. Well, hello, Chris. I'm so happy that you could join me on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Stacey. Good to see you.
Well, I loved your book so much. It's got to be one of my favorite memoirs that I've read lately, and I've read quite a few of them. It really hits my sweet spot when it comes to memoirs because it strikes such a great balance between the personal and the professional. I'd love to know how your co-writer, is it Catherine Ketchum? Is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, Catherine Ketchum.
Kathy. How did you guys connect and how did you collaborate?
Actually, we met through a mutual friend, William Moyer, who she had done his autobiography to, helped him with that, his first one. At first she said, oh, I'm really busy. Why I went towards her is she's written books on addiction.
Right.
She was a woman and she understood addiction. And those were two real important things for me in putting all of this down.
Now, being present during the Beatles recording sessions for the White Album, which is one of my favorites, and Abbey Road, I'm thinking that must have been surreal. But then again, it was your everyday life. So I'm wondering, is there a specific moment in the studio that kind of captured the magic of their creative process for you?
That happened quite frequently. It was the very first time I went into the studio with the help of Pete Schott and John Lennon's friend. And we went down into the studio. Abbey Road was two stories. The control room was on the top floor. And John came down with Yoko and said, come on, you two, I need your help. And I was like, are you kidding? I don't sing. But it was nothing more than clapping. And as it turned out, I thought it was Revolution Number 9, but I think it was Revolution Number 1. much slower version, and we put claps on it. And then at the very end, the thing that I remember is John suddenly just crumbled up this piece of paper. Just that's all. But it was a sound effect. And I went, all right, this is the kind of thing they do. I knew that from the records I'd listened to and reading about them. And so that stuck in my mind.
Yeah, that is such a simple yet effective gesture. Well, another part of your book that I really loved was about your friendship with Patty Boyd, which endured over so many years. But it also put you at the center of one of the most infamous love triangles in rock and roll history. How did you navigate your relationships with George Harrison and Eric Clapton and Patty during this period?
Well, it wasn't my favorite time. Let me put it that way. I was pretty slow to figure out what was going on. I thought that, Eric would come to Friar Park. He'd say, okay, I'm gonna, why don't you come and spend a few days with me? And he'd come and pick, we weren't having a relationship or anything, but we were friends. And so I thought that he was, but I thought, well, maybe he likes me. Because he kept calling and kept coming over to Friar Park, and then I discovered it had nothing to do with me at all. But it took me a really long time to figure that out. So when I was working for Derek and the Dominoes and had helped them find a flat in London, and I was staying there, is when I started finding out about the relationship, and they used it as a rendezvous spot. So I didn't like that very much. Patty was my friend, first and foremost. But my loyalty to George was he was a very good friend. And so I felt pretty loyal to him. And it kind of got me angry at Eric. And I think, though, over the years, Eric and I eventually, we were friends and then we didn't get along. And a lot of it had to do with the abuse of drugs and alcohol, probably more than anything. My loyalty remained with George through it, but my friendship with Patty stayed through that relationship too. We made it through Eric. Yeah.
That is, yeah, that's an amazing time in rock history. And I also love your stories about Leon Russell. Just he wrote the best love songs, and he wrote Pisces Apple Lady for you. Also, people that listen to this podcast that are fans of my dad's band, The Ventures, know that they covered one of his songs in 1966, and then he played keyboards on another song of theirs. So that was kind of, it was a short period of time in your life, I guess, when you were with Leon, but it packed so much into it. I'm wondering, how you look back on that now, and did you keep in touch with him after the two of you split up?
I did, but first I have to tell you, I love The Ventures. That
Oh,
is so cool that you, I would love to hear your story about growing up with a musician. That's a whole nother story, isn't it?
Right? Yes.
Leon and I, yeah, it was short, but everything back then seemed like years, and it was really only months, you know? I moved to LA with him, and it was fairly apparent to me early on that I was not cut out to be an old lady. I wanted,
That term,
I
huh?
know, I didn't, I just couldn't do that one. It was like, but I need to be doing something. I need to have some value here. And just being your girlfriend isn't really enough. So it wasn't destined to be a long romance, but it was destined to be a long friendship. So we kept in touch. You know, I think if he came to Tucson, I would go see him play and always say hi. And I spoke to him on the phone every so often. So I didn't see him much after that, in fact. Oh, well, I did when I went to the concerts to see him. But yeah, we remained in touch, which was nice.
One of my favorite kind of eras in rock history is the early 1970s and the Rolling Stones. I feel like were really at their peak, and they were just so full of innovation and energy. And you worked one of their tours, 1972. And I loved hearing your stories about, I mean, there's so many. I really encourage people to read the book. But what was the one unexpected or maybe a surreal moment for you during that time on the road with them?
Well, I worked for them for a year as their assistant, and then went on the road. Wasn't really supposed to be there. Mick and Keith just and Bill Wyman said, "You're coming," so I went. But I think, it was amazing how many different people came on the tour. Truman Capote, Lee Radziwill. I couldn't even begin to name all of Terry Southern, the writer who wrote Candy. And it was such a confusing time. I remember Terry Southern one day. We were in New Orleans, and I saw him in the lobby with his suitcase with clothes hanging out. Like he didn't quite get it closed right. And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, we're leaving." I said, "No, we don't go. We don't leave today. We leave tomorrow." So,
Oh.
what city are we in? I mean, it was a really interesting time. But I think probably most memorable during that period of time was what I think it was just the way that the whole tour went. There were a lot of drugs, there was a lot of fun, there was great music, and there was a film being made at the same time. It was just it's crazy. It was absolutely crazy, but I loved it.
Yeah, it shows in your book that you are an appreciator of music and creativity and talent. And one of those artists, for me especially, is Bob Dylan. He's one of my all-time favorites. And the Rolling Thunder Review is just an amazing time in Dylan's history. And but you only mention it kind of briefly in your memoir. I know you're focusing more on the Beatles and the Stones, but can you share an experience with me from that tour and maybe what made it feel different from other tours that you were on?
Oh, it was so different. First of all, I knew Bob through George. We had met. And so Bob isn't the most warm and fuzzy person.
Right.
So I guess, but he knew I had come. I was a friend of George's, so he let me in, and by that I mean he talked to me. He talked to me. We had conversations. But I think that what was so amazing about it is that it just nobody knew where we were going. The except for a few of us who organized it, no one on the tour, the musicians, nobody knew what cities we would be in 3 days. We would put out an itinerary with a couple days on it just so they could tell their family where they were going to be. But that was it. It was kept a secret what cities we were going to go into. So, and the only reason they knew is we sent people ahead to those towns who would then start putting out flyers and go on the radio and put the word out. So it was actually a magical mystery tour, more than a Rolling Thunder tour in its own
Well,
way.
that sounds
So,
like a pop-up, like what people would say
yeah,
is a pop-up now, right?
it was probably the first pop-up concert tour ever. Yeah.
Did you have any favorite Bob Dylan tunes that you look forward to hearing on the tour?
Yes, every tour I worked on, and I worked on a bunch of them, every one I had certain songs that I would go out front and watch. And on that tour, there were three in a row. He would do one more cup of coffee. I don't even know if I can remember the other two now. I think Sarah was one of them.
Oh
And
gosh, I love that song. It's
yeah.
such a beautiful love song.
It's absolutely beautiful. And it's funny, I went to see a concert the other night, Cat Power doing Bob Dylan. Cat Power's doing Bob Dylan. And it occurred to me that, well, he was not my favorite artist in the early days. I wasn't into him so much. I got into him after Like a Rolling or Rolling Stone, Like a Rolling Stone. But all of his later music I love. And I realized it is really hard for anyone to do Bob Dylan. She did a great job. She has an amazing voice, but only Bob can do Bob.
your memoir, Miss Odell, is just, it's so honest and a bit self-critical. Maybe you're a little too hard on yourself at times, but was it difficult to strike the balance between sharing your experiences, which are deeply personal and only you can have, but also to be respectful of the people who shared in those experiences who have famous names?
Yeah, it was difficult. And you know, it didn't always succeed. I mean, there were golden rules during those years with probably most of those bands that you just don't talk about it. And I thought after 40 some years, perhaps we could do that now. So, and you know, honestly, there were a few people upset about it, but the truth of the matter is that, you know, it's history. And also, I was a woman when there weren't a lot of women around doing those kind of jobs. So I felt it was important to write it. And I really actually thought as I wrote it, I really didn't think, I thought the people that would read it that I knew, the friends I was writing about, would actually get a hold of me and say, "Wow, I didn't know you went through that." And some did, some didn't. So, but I'm very proud of it. I really am proud of that book.
Yeah, you definitely should be. And what I'm kind of curious to know what your process was of remembering all those things. Was it, did you keep a journal or how did that work?
I am really good at keeping journals. I've kept them since 1970, I think, but or 1973. But actually, there, my memory, it does these sort of short, like these shorts, film shorts in my head. That's how I remember things. So quite a while back, probably in the 80s, I started writing stories down that I remembered. And when it came down to doing the book, the chapters actually are, in a way, those short films that I had in my head. So they're, you know, they were pretty clear, and I'm glad I did it because today I don't know if I can remember all of it.
Right. Yeah, it's good to always keep records, especially when you live the life that you do. And that's a good analogy because I could really picture a lot of what you are writing about. It's quite vivid. So it does feel like little short films. Each chapter is its own encapsulated story, which is great. Now I'm wondering, looking back on your experiences, what do you think is the biggest misconception that people now have about the rock and roll lifestyle of the 60s and 70s?
A lot of it was true. I mean, really, when you say sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that really was what it was about the 60s and the 70s. We were the generation that, you know, following World War II. And, you know, so we were raised by parents who hadn't had everything. They'd gone without a lot. And I think they gave us a lot to make up for it. And I think what that did is that just took away all our boundaries. We were just, you know, the pill came out. There was just so much that was suddenly available, and we were an experimental generation. So I think that there's a lot of truth to that. I do think that maybe a misconception would be that they didn't, we weren't seriously working and doing a lot of good stuff, and that musicians are actually, they work really hard. They go in the studio and they work really hard. And being on tour is one of the most difficult. I don't know. I mean, I don't even know how we did it. You almost have to be, I don't know how these guys are doing it who are going back on the road, because it's really hard work.
Yes, it is. And I always feel like, how did Keith Richards do that and still be so brilliant? How can you be so functional on heavy drugs?
You know, it's the eighth wonder of the world. But I only had a conversation with someone about 4 days ago about this very fact that he, you know, when I worked with him, his on tour, his thing was to stay up as many days as possible.
Wow.
And that, I mean, today you think about that, you think, wow, that's crazy. But here he is. He seems to be, you know, he has as much energy as Mick And that's a miracle too, the way
It
making
is.
perform on stage still.
Yeah, I
So
love it. I
yeah,
think it's great.
we're watching all of these people kind of go and from our time, but there's Keith.
I know, right? Yeah,
Yeah.
sadly, we lost Chris Kristofferson recently, who was
Yeah.
a favorite of mine, another extremely talented, beautiful lyricist. But we have their music, which lives on forever. So we have that, which is great. Now, in your book, I know you had some trepidations, of course, like any young person going out in the world for the first time, but you were free and seemingly fearless in your autonomy. I mean, you would pick up and move from England to LA and back again. And although the times were more sexist back then, I feel like a life like yours really couldn't be replicated today. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, actually, I think you're right. And it's kind of, women have made a lot of progress since then, definitely. I mean, I literally was the only female tour manager in at least the part of rock and roll that I knew. And, I look back now and I don't know how that happened because, but, well, I always say if the Beatles are at the top of your resume, you have. That's pretty much all you can ask for, right?
Right.
I'll tell you, I don't know. I think today there are women doing many other things that we could not have done back then. So I guess it comes down to the fact that we took these baby steps and now there are giant steps being taken. Yeah. I always say Linda Ronstadt was one of the very, when you think
Yes.
about what she went, she was one of the top, she, Joni Mitchell, some of these women. And yet it was hard for them. And there
That's
were only
true.
a few of them. So.
Yeah, I'll never forget a story that I also just remember from my reading and whatnot that Rolling Stone had published an article, a feature article about Joni Mitchell, but it was a timeline of all the men she's left with, which was just so sexist. And she didn't speak to anyone at Rolling Stone for years because they wouldn't do that with a man. They would talk about their musicianship and their business acumen, which she had as well.
Exactly.
So, well, this is the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. So I have to ask you, what is your own personal rock and roll nightmare?
Well, one of them was at Friar Park. Friar Park, I mean, I was told when I first moved there to live with George and Patty that it was haunted. I have to say, I didn't see it, but I remember the night that Terry Doran, who worked for George, he came into the kitchen and he went, "I just saw a ghost." And it was around the galley of the main hall. And we all had to go up that way to get to our bedrooms. And I
Oh no.
remember I was like, "Oh, can I sleep in the living? Can I sleep somewhere else tonight? I don't want to go up there." It was a little edgy living there at that time. And the other nightmare was I went to the Isle of Wight to see Bob Dylan when he had first come out of his early retirement, which was what, 1969, I think, or yeah, 69. And I went with another guy I worked with at Apple, Bill Oakes. And as we flew in on a helicopter, which was fine, and landed in Bob Dylan's backyard because we had his harmonicas he'd forgotten.
How
And
does
so I
Bob
thought,
Dylan forget his harmonicas?
who knows, but he did. But thank him because it got us a helicopter ride to the Isle of Wight. And then when we went to the concert, and then afterwards, John Lennon said, "You guys have a way back to London. We've got a private plane." So we went, "Oh, great. Okay." So we jumped on the plane with John and Yoko and a few other people that worked for him and started passing the hashish. And suddenly I thought, oh my God, there's no divider. There was like a curtain between us and the pilot. And I thought, I'm high. He must be high. And so I convinced myself he was going to do what he always wanted to do, which was go straight up like a rocket. And then we hit turbulence. And I was like, oh no. And then John and Yoko started chanting Hare Krishna. And I went, okay, now we're really in trouble. So
Oh
I was
no.
convinced that I was going to be, there was going to be a front page saying that John and Yoko died and also were two Apple employees.
Right.
That did scare me. Those were nightmares.
Yeah, so you went from walking the ghostly gauntlet to almost becoming a ghost yourself, but I'm glad that you're still here to tell your wonderful stories. And you have a great website that I have to compliment you on, missodell.com, which is just put together so very well.
You.
Is there any information that you'd like to add to social media that you're on, any projects, documentary?
Well, my documentary, which is called Miss Odell, should be out in the next month or so. It's finally finished. We did it a year ago, January in London. We filmed it and went back through a lot of the Beatle days with friends that came to talk to me and just kind of went through all that period of time. And I'm really pleased with it too. So it'll be on streaming, and I won't know probably for another week where. So I'll post it on my
Oh,
website.
great. And then you're on social media too?
I'm on Facebook, and I think that puts me on Instagram, although I don't spend, yeah. So I'm
Yeah.
on those, right?
Awesome. Well, thank you, Chris. I sure do appreciate your time today.
Yeah, I appreciate you in interviewing me.
Well, I encourage everyone to read your book and check out the documentary, which I will definitely be doing as well.
Thank you very much.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening. Well, she's by